This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Step inside and find out what you need to know about the issues that matter from people who really understand what they're talking about. And you can subscribe to the podcast via BBC Sounds. If it works for you, and especially if it doesn't and you know how maybe it could, tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider. This week, we're talking about yellow vests. In French, they're known rather more elegantly as les gilets jaunes, the people who've taken to the streets of France in protest at President Macron. Our question is simple. Que se passe-t-il en France? The people singing the songs of angry men. It's the song of people in high-vis jackets blockading roundabouts all over France. It started with a planned tax increase that would have raised the price of diesel. And then the protest arrived in Paris and turned violent. Suddenly, President Macron was facing a political crisis just 18 months after being elected, promising a new beginning. It's all gone rather miserable, rather fast. So what's going on in France? Step into the briefing room to find out. First, let's remind ourselves about President Macron and his political movement En Marche. What do they want to do and how do they plan to achieve it? I'm joined in the briefing room by Sophie Pedder, who's written a biography of Emmanuel Macron. She's in Paris, where she's also the bureau chief of The Economist. Sophie Pedder, take us back to that kind of dim, distant era of 2017 when Emmanuel Macron was elected. And what was his appeal to the French voters, do you think?
Well, I think partly it was freshness. You know, there was this idea that it was always the same old faces on the left, on the right, and the appeal of someone new who talked a different kind of language, who seemed in phase with the, you know, the changes that are going on in society. He was really into sort of tech. He was a different generation, and he hadn't been tarred by a past in any sort of party politics. So it was the freshness and the idea that he had really reached out by consulting people with a kind of grassroots discussions that led to the creation of En Marche. It felt just a very different way of doing politics.
So the feeling was then that he was in touch with people.
He was in touch with people. He had created in the summer after launching on Mars, he had held these consultations called La Grande Marche, and this involved going out with surveys, literally thousands of people across the country, knocking on doors, asking people what they felt, what they wanted from politics. It was an attempt to listen to people on the ground and to sort of get beyond the left-right divide that seemed to just create stalemates all the time in Parliament.
Now, listening is one thing, doing is another thing. So when Macron started, what did he think his agenda had to be? What were the big things he thought needed doing, and how did he think he was going to do them?
Well, he was wanting to, in his words, unblock France. What he felt was it was a too rigid society and it didn't allow people to sort of make the best of their own abilities. And this involved introducing some elements of flexibility, for example, in the labour market, trying to make it easier for companies to feel that there wasn't such a risk in hiring people, trying to reduce that risk and therefore encourage them to create proper long-term permanent job contracts, but also to try and invest in early education, in apprenticeships, trying to give people the means to make better life for themselves too. This was his sort of empowerment agenda. So the two were supposed to go hand in hand and encourage the private sector, not punish the wealth creators. And it was all with the idea of trying to unblock what had felt like a very rigid French society that didn't do itself justice.
What approach did he take to the presidency itself, the manner of the presidency, which was supposed to help him do those things?
Well, I think you need to go back and remember what the presidency was like under François Hollande, his predecessor. Don't forget that Macron was an advisor for a couple of years at the Élysée Palace under Hollande. And what he felt, and Hollande had been elected saying he wanted to bring about a normal presidency. And what I think Macron felt, and certainly a lot of the French felt, was that somehow he had lost the sort of authority and stature of the presidency had disappeared. There wasn't a sense of dignity about the presidency at that time. And so Macron had developed this concept of a sort of Jupiterian president, which didn't seem so absurd after Hollande, but the problem with it, I think, was that it reached its limits pretty soon. You know, initially, I think the French quite liked having a president who represented France well on the world stage. But I think after a while, that reached its limits. And that's when people began to see it not as a positive thing, but more of a reflection of a president who was out of touch and bordering on sort of arrogant towards or even disconnected from ordinary people. And that, I think, is where things started to go wrong.
Wasn't it obvious to him that there was always going to be a problem when the Jupiterian presidency came up against the listening presidency?
I think that's where he neglected the implications of that. And I think that if you look at what he's tried to do over the last few months, even before these fuel protests erupted on the French streets, he was beginning to recognise that this was an issue. He'd started to talk about, you know, I've made mistakes or I've failed to reconnect people with their political leaders. And I think that there was an effort there to introduce a bit more sort of humility and to try and get out and talk to people in a much more direct way. But I think it probably came a bit too late.
How successful had his reform programme been up until the Gilets Jaunes moment?
Well, this is the interesting thing, and it's one of the sort of contradictions or the paradoxes about what's going on at the moment, that actually over the last 18 months, he's pretty much pushed through everything that he had put in his manifesto and that he said he would do, and that would go from labour market reform, reform of the SNCF.
That's the railway.
The French railways, absolutely. He's reformed the school leaving exam, the baccalaureate. He's changed university entrance selection. He has put in place a number of reforms which have gone through with demonstrations. I mean, there have been union-led protests, but he had put these in place, and on the whole, he got public opinion behind him for them. There was seemed to be a real consensus. There was an extraordinary feeling, I think, that actually over 18 months he'd done a lot.
So why has the Gilets Jaunes movement been so problematic for him?
Well, I think the core issue was probably the sequencing of his tax reforms. And at the very beginning, Macron was very keen to restore credibility with Berlin and with Brussels by bringing down the budget deficit to below 3%, which France hadn't done for over a decade. And the only way he was going to do this is if he delayed some of his tax cuts. And what he wanted to do at the same time was to show investors that France was no longer hostile to wealth creation. And therefore, he brought down taxes taxes on companies, he abolished the wealth tax, and he brought down taxes on investment income. And at the same time, he postponed cuts in a payroll charge, which would benefit ordinary people. And I think it's that sequencing. So he had this tag, the president of the rich, which stuck to him and is now very much part of the sort of discourse of those who are protesting on the streets. And I think it's, you know, in retrospect, the two should have gone hand in hand in the way in which he brought about the tax changes.
Sophie Pedder in Paris. Of course, much of the media's focus has been on the capital, those images of the vandalised Arc de Triomphe. But les Gilets jaunes, the men and women in the yellow vests, have appeared on the streets all over the country, mostly not in riot mode. Who are they? Christophe Guillouis, who's written extensively about what he calls la France périphérique, offers his reflection on where the Gilets jaunes have come from.
La France périphérique, c'est la France des...
What I mean by that is the France of the lower classes. These are workers, farmers, small business owners, basically what we would previously have called the lower middle class. These are people who live in rural areas, in small towns and villages, and what they have in common is that they live far away from the large metropolitan centres, far away from Paris and Lyon. And what these people have in common is that they are in regions that create very little work.
C'est un ras-le-bol général.
We've all had enough. It's been going on for so long, and eventually you have to resist. There's no choice.
Like all other Western countries, we've had the crisis of deindustrialization. The working class was the first to be hit by that, but we compensated for that in France by creating a lot of public sector jobs. But we can't do that anymore because the state has got in so much debt, and it can't create any more jobs like that.
Who are you?
We are the people. You don't have to look any further. Not right, not left. We're just the simple people.
This doesn't necessarily mean that people don't have jobs any longer, but it does mean that if they lose their jobs, they find it very difficult to find a new one. So you've got whole groups who are scared of losing their jobs, and given how much they get paid, they're finding it hard to make ends meet at the end of the month.
The problem is much bigger than just the fuel tax. That was just the straw that broke the camel's back. The distress has been brewing for years. It's time to make ourselves felt.
I think the fuel tax is only a pretext. It's only a symptom. It's not really what this whole thing is about. The groups that have been out protesting are groups that have been weakened since right back in the 1980s. First it was the industrial workers, then it was the farmers, then it was the white-collar workers, and these people are now beginning to examine the deal that was sold to them. It's not that the French working class was against globalisation. It's not that it was against Europe. They went along with all that. But now they have realised that their future is no longer secure, and nor is their children's future. And that's also very important. So then they are told that they have to go and look for a job where the labour market is dynamic. The problem with that is that the places where there are jobs are the big cities, and these jobs are inaccessible simply from a practical point of view, from the point of view of where you're going to live. It's impossible to find a place in Paris if you're on low wages. It's impossible. So there's work in Paris, in Toulouse, in Lyon, but the problem is we have an economic model which isn't bad. It creates wealth, but it just doesn't include most people.
We don't eat as we'd like to every day. It's not normal, not normal. How long will this last? I think it's not normal, so the protesters should continue.
There hasn't been some kind of plot. No one decided to disenfranchise the working class. It's all happened slowly as the economy was reorganized. But we can see today that these groups have become invisible. We forgot that the poor still existed, and that's why the image of the gilet jaune, the yellow vest, is very important. When you put your high-vis vest on, it's so you can be seen in the street. So here we have a whole group of invisible people who've put their vests on in order to be seen.
The people of Europe, the people of France are being drained little by little, with taxes and all sorts. So we've had enough. It has to stop.
I would say that there are more cultural differences between Paris and this France of the periphery than there is between Paris and New York. If you go from Paris to New York or Stockholm or London, you meet the same people who think more or less in the same way. And yet at the same time, this cultural difference has emerged with people in the countryside.
Abraham Lincoln said something important. He said that government should be of the people, by the people, for the people. For the people. Our politicians should keep that in mind. They won't get anywhere until they put the people first.
I've been saying for 20 years that there is a sick elephant in the China shop, and I've kept being told, no, there's no elephant. Well, the elephant has now put on a high-vis vest, and now we can see it.
Christophe Guilloui. The most obvious demand the protesters have been making has already been met. The government has withdrawn the planned tax increase on diesel. But will this be enough to appease the anger? Joining me now in the briefing room is Bruno Jeanbart from the polling organisation Opinion Way. Bruno Jeanbart, how significant has public opinion support been for the Gilets Jaunes protests?
It's a massive support since the beginning. In our polls, we have about 65-68% of the people saying that they are supporting the movement and the protest, which is very high. But what is the most striking in this situation is the fact that it's not moving since the beginning. I mean, we had 2 weekends of violence in Paris. We had Macron's speech 10 days ago. We had Philippe's announcement this week.
And that announcement was the announcement postponing the fuel tax rise.
Exactly. And what it seems is that it doesn't do any effect on the public opinion and on the support, not increasing it, nor decreasing it. So it seems very stable. It seems that it was a kind of expression no more on the movement itself, but on Macron's policy.
Okay, so are opinion polls able to measure what support is for specific demands of the protesters?
One of the most difficult things is that there is no clear demand of the protest and of the people of the protest. And that may explain the main support and the major support to the protest, because everybody is able to say and to put his demand on the idea that he has of the protest. But when you look at the demand and how they are seen by public opinion, there's a lot of contradiction on it. People are agreeing with the fact that you have to decrease tax, but they are also agreeing with the fact that you should put more money on public services, that you maybe put back the ESF, which is the tax on the wealthiest. There is a lot of contradiction also on the public opinion, and we have the same if we are talking about environment and the relationship to ecology. People are saying that they want to do more to protect the earth and to fight against climate change, but they are also supporting this movement, which says that we don't want to have a tax to do that.
What are the stages of Emmanuel Macron's growing unpopularity?
Macron's unpopularity is really real now. It's about 28% of people who say that they are satisfied of his action as president, which is very low. It's comparing to Hollande at the same period. It has decreased a lot since last May, and especially during the summer. And I think that this decrease has really prepared what is happening now, because as he's more weaker than it was a few months ago, it was easier for the movement and the protest to grow and to be supported by public opinion.
Are there any signs that him having to back down on the fuel tax has improved his situation in any way?
Not yet. We don't know. But it's too early, because the first announcement of the Prime Minister was on Tuesday. The confirmation of that was on last night, saying that it's not a suspension but a cancellation. So we have to wait a little. I guess at the end of the week we'll see a new poll saying or no if it has an impact on the support of the movement. The other answer to that will be what's going to happen on Saturday. They have a huge demonstration again, or will it be more quiet than the last week?
Is there a danger that he will go from being seen as being strong and unpopular to being seen as weak and unpopular?
I think it's possible, but it's not the case for the moment, because when you look at popularity of Macron, he's now around in the same area than Hollande at the same time, much more lower than Sarkozy at the same time, but like Hollande. But I think his personal image is much more stronger than Hollande. Macron is still seen as someone who is able to be president, is strong in international issues, and representing quite well the country abroad and inside. And that's still a force for him, which may make him today unpopular, but not someone who is seen as not the right man at the right place.
Bruno Jean-Bart. So what can President Macron do now? He's been in office only a year and a half. His presidency is safe for another 3 years, you'd think. But changing his programme and his style are also tricky. Can he weather the winter storm? I've invited two experts into the briefing room to discuss this. Jane Weston-Vauclair is an author and historian. She's in Paris. Joining me in the studio here is Professor Philippe Marlière, who is an expert in French politics at University College London. Jane Weston-Vauclair, how does Paris feel today? And are they making preparations in case there are more big demonstrations this weekend?
I would say that the biggest signs of the preparations being made are not visible to the naked eye in Paris at this point. It's more what we're seeing on the news, discussions by the chief of the police in terms of the way that they're going to change their tactics in relation to last weekend. But otherwise, I would say in Paris, so pretty normal atmosphere, nothing particular to report.
Philippe Marlière, what do you think about Macron's management of the crisis since it began?
Well, not a very good one, to be fair, because the crisis has been on for 3 weeks now, and I think it took him at least 2 weeks, if not 2.5 weeks, really, to come forward and address the sort of grievances of those Gilets Jaunes. He did a few things lately, and I think he made the very big decision of scrapping the tax on fuel, which was essentially the starting point of this kind of rebellion. But I think for the first past 2 weeks, essentially what he was saying, and he was very much keeping low profile. I think the few words he said were, as they put, you know, this reform is good. It's about so-called ecological transition. We must address that, and taxing fuel, which is a polluting thing, of course, is a thing to do. So that's essentially, and of course, that really didn't help. And I think one of the reasons why the situation escalated, and I think we're still there today, and it's not over, it's partly because the first 2 weeks he didn't really address the concerns of the population.
And does it look to the protesters and the French public, Jane, that he's in a panic?
No, I don't think he seems to be in a panic. I would say that for everybody, this has escalated very quickly. People are watching to see what will transpire. He's keeping a low profile. He's not planning to make a public statement until after next weekend. And in fact, the announcement about the scrapping of the fuel tax was made by his spokespeople and not by himself. So his low profile, you know, in a way, doesn't allow for panic to leak through.
Philippe Marlière, looking at the protests themselves, I mean, here's the big demand of the original demand of the protesters, now completely conceded. So why don't they just all now go home?
But I think, as we've just said, you know, the fact he took him a very long time to really address and engage with sort of people's concerns and this question on tax on fuel makes it very difficult now to sort of move on, because people are now really, really angry. And as you've noticed, that the initial claim, you know, concentrating on taxation on fuel has moved on and now reached other areas. You know, it's about minimum wage, it's about the state of public services, it's about pay, it's about poverty. And this is more serious. That's why I think my guess is today it's a bit too little too late, that this thing, had it really made that decision about a week ago, that could have probably helped finish the demonstration. But I think what also is to be monitored and looked at is the radicalization of those protesters. It's getting quite personal against Macron. It's a lot of acrimony and even hatred, personal hatred directed at him. And also, still the popular support is there.
Okay, but Jane Weston-Vauclair, what is the popular support actually for? If in the first instance it was support for the protesters' demand over the fuel tax, which has now been met, what will the public now sign up to support them to do, and for what purpose?
Well, that is the huge question now. I really think the coming weekend is going to be quite decisive on that point, because there have been calls for wider strikes. How well followed will they be? They will be the sign of how much support the movement continues to have. I'd also point out, I think that Mélenchon put his finger on it rather well at
this
debate yesterday.
This is the far-left leader,
Indeed, yes, exactly. He described Macron yesterday as this presidential monarch who wants to manage France like a startup. So we have a lot of, you know, sort of sensitive topics here in one criticism. We've got the, you know, as Philip said, there's this sort of idea that he's aloof, he's seen as a sort of regal figure, which never goes down well here if it's overdone. The idea that he wants to manage France, you know, very technocratic, and to sort of push through reforms very quickly, you know, in the manner of a startup. You know, when you talk about a startup in French, we think Amazon, we think, you know, sort of new methods that can sweep people away and cause real damage to people's lives. If you combine that with what really seems to have been a deaf ear to massive concerns of people, you do have to ask, will this one step down be enough?
OK, well, in that case, that begs the question slightly about what he can do. But first, Philippe Marlier, isn't this actually just a pattern in French politics, which is you get a new leader in, they say they're all kind of relatively keen, etc., sweep away the old. Then as soon as the leader starts doing something, they start protesting against it, take to the streets, and everybody moans.
Yes, probably. I think that was at least the fate of the two previous presidents, Sarkozy and Hollande. The honeymoon was very, very short-lived. But I think what is really interesting is that to run France like a kind of a startup, yes, but he could have just managed to get that through, you know, with the actual support with the sort of moderate voters of the centre-left and centre-right, the new majority coalition he's got there. But it's really the lack of compassion and respect, which are now the big problems and which sort of have really inflamed the whole situation. People feel that, he doesn't listen, but also he's a condescending figure. He doesn't really treat people, with respect. You know, there are several anecdotal stories, you know, evidence that, of that. You know, when once he infamously said to an unemployed man who was talking to him in the street, you know, it's easy to find a job. You know, if I cross the street, I'm sure I would find a job. So that doesn't really go down well with people when you talk to them like that. And I think he's made a number of gaffes of that nature.
But now, gaffes like that, presumably, are correctable. I mean, you can go out and you can say, look, I can see that I didn't quite sort of connect in the right way. I'm launching a great kind of listening project. Is the crisis manageable by such forms? Or are things at such a bad pitch so quickly that actually this won't suffice?
He's got to probably change his style. I would even say he's got to change his economic policy, I think, because all those issues are very much revolved around bread and butter issues. It's really the bottom line is people are fed up with austerity, with further neoliberal policies. That is really a fact. And it's a fact which is now, it's not simply a thing of the left, because the Gilets Jaunes are in fact apolitical in that sense. You can't say they're left wing or right wing. It's a mix of both or nothing. But I think he's got to change policy and his style. He's got now to be probably more humble and engage more. And so far he's been unable to do that.
We heard earlier that one of the advantages that Macron continues to have is that opinion polls still show that people think he is a viable president. In other words, he represents the country presidentially well. Is that something that he can build upon in order to retrieve his position? Or is the analysis that somehow or other what has happened in the last few weeks and what may happen in the next few weeks has knocked him over for good?
It's a good question, because it's really a question about the state of French politics altogether. And I think things have changed dramatically since the last presidential election. The two main parties which had dominated French politics over the past 30 to 40 years have collapsed. On the right, the Les Républicains, former Sarkozy's party, and on the left, centre-left, the Socialists, in complete disarray, almost fighting for their survival today. So what's left? There's Macron with the new electorally hegemonic bloc, electorally, because politically, the events are showing, it's less sure that it's got strong support and backing, but at least electorally, he's got the majority. But I would say he's got the majority by default, because what's the alternative to Macron today, since the two traditional big parties of French politics are down? It's Mélenchon, the radical left, and Le Pen. Not a very attractive proposition to most French people.
Do you think the Gilets Jaunes will set up their own party in some way?
Well, some have floated the idea. I don't think really it's on the agenda because the movement is so heterogeneous, so volatile, that clearly it would take a lot. I think you remember there's a precedent, Pujad himself, Robert Pujad.
I did him at school, right?
Yes,
kind of half remember.
Back in the 1950s, you know, out of nowhere, a shopkeeper, and finally he sort of established his own party, which wasn't very, very long life, by the way. I don't think that's really the sort of, that would be the outcome. The outcome is really, again, there will be a period of confrontation with power at the moment that will probably calm down. But I think after that, it will be back to traditional politics. And we shall see only then who has benefited from this Gilets Jaunes movement.
My thanks to Professor Philippe Malière there, Jane Weston-Vauclair, Sophie Pedder, Christophe Guilloui and Bruno Jean-Bart. We'll be back next week. À la prochaine. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Tom Hill. And you can subscribe to this podcast via BBC Sounds, and you can let us know what you think about it by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.